Hi, everybody. I'm Casey. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Dave, for the kind words. It's been through a loving God, strong sponsorship, the 12 steps and traditions of that one in the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, working with others that I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a drug since August 17th, 1996, and for that I'm not truly grateful enough. And now with my braces, I feel like I'm whistling, you know, with this microphone, because I slur, so I hear it. It's great. So, great. I'm studying to be a teacher. My kids are like, you're scary with braces. I'm like, oh, thanks. So, powerlessness. It's so funny. You know, Dave asked me on Thursday. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to be speaking on powerlessness. And I was asking God. And he's completely reminded me in the last 4 days how powerless I am. You know, before that, I was feeling pretty powerful in my life. I make a lot of good decisions. I compete, fight, in jiu-jitsu. So I was like, I'm powerful. I'm strong. Got my butt kicked every day, was panting. I'm like, oh, I asked about powerlessness, and now I'm feeling it all over again. Just a joke, kind of like I always find that when I ask God about things going on in my life and to show them clearly, he shows them to me very clearly. So I'm really careful about what I ask. About what it was like for me, I come from an alcoholic home. The parts of the story where I talk about my mom, who is Cass, a lot of people know her, I have her permission. You know, and we kind of have a different perspective of how, what happened, so it's interesting. But I came from an alcoholic household, and I didn't really know the effects of alcohol had on my household until I got sober. But when I was a kid, I was this shy, scrawny kid, and I say shy because I am so not shy at all. Nobody in sobriety would know me as shy. But I was so afraid of the world. I really was. And I was, I wanted just to be sheltered. I kind of felt like I had this typical TV life, like Leave It to Beaver. My mom was Jude Cleaver. You know, if you know Cass, that's totally not who she is, so it's really funny, you know. You know, she'll sue people. She's like very like righteous. You know, I love my mom to death. And my mom decided that she wanted a stone house. So she bought a castle in Whitehall, New York. And I was living in Queens at the time, and I had this culture shock because I didn't know what a mile was. I wasn't used to anything like this. I wasn't used to trees like this before or anything. I got lost in the woods for hours. You know, I got lost once, and I wound up in Vermont. I lived in New York. I wound up in Vermont, and I called my mom. But I called my mom and said, Mom, I'm in Vermont. She's like, you have to walk home. The bar is open, so I can't come and get you because she owned a restaurant. I was like, it's Vermont. She's like, I know. I'm like, okay. And four of us walked home. There's four of us. And I was like, don't go exploring in the woods, you know. And I was kind of in the shy shell, not feeling really adequate. I was seeing that alcohol was taking effect in my mom's life because she was always running this restaurant and this bar, but I didn't understand what was going on. And then the worst thing happened that I felt is that my parents got divorced. And, you know, up to that point, I felt like truly loved. I was a good student. I was a straight A. I was really highly sensitive, though. I will say this. Anytime someone upset me, I would find a gardening tool in Queens, and I would chase some blocks with a gardening tool, like with a hoe, and, like, throw it at their back, you know, but I was hyperventilating, bawling. You know, I never had a normal reaction to emotions, ever. But then when my parents got divorced, I felt that I did something wrong. And like, what was wrong with me? Like, I'll do something better. Like, I just did not want this to happen. And I really blamed myself for it. And I can tell you, I don't know anything I did wrong, but I thought it's something I did, that I caused a stress in my family. And no matter how much my parents told me that that wasn't the case, that feeling never went away from me. My mom, then her drinking escalated, and I started to see less and less of her, being that she was running a business. I started taking care of my brother, getting us ready for school. My mom was never up anymore. You know, I helped him with all his homework. I cooked all our meals. We had to hide when the business was open. It wasn't like this glamorous life of living in a castle, what everybody thought, you know. When my mom was drunk, we came up with escape routes throughout the castle, you know, like, run, go up the secret staircase, then run down this hallway, jump out the second floor window onto the roof, and then climb down the big tree, and then run into the woods. You know, we had various escape routes. That way my mom could never catch us. And our whole life feeling was like, if you never catch us, then we're never in trouble. You know, so we just hid from her all the time because she would eventually forget what exactly we did wrong. And so I started, my mom had to hire a babysitter. And the reason why I'm talking all about this is because, you know, when I got sober, you know, I learned that my drinking didn't cause my character defects. My character defects caused my drinking. You know, and I wasn't able to handle life. And I tried and explored all these different avenues, and I had all these emotional things going on. And while all this was going on, I was like 8 and 9 years old, I never told everyone I was okay. I don't know if you're supposed to at 8 years old, but no one even asked me either, you know? Like, my parents got divorced, I moved to a new town. None of my teachers really knew me, so no one really asked if I was okay, and I wasn't. I was really upset over the whole thing. I was spending a lot of time in Queens hanging out with my dad. So I was seeing that drinking was taking such a great part of my mom's life that I started getting my babysitters drunk when I had them. And, you know, at the castle, I would have a babysitter, and I'd go behind the bar, and they'd order a Coke, and I'd throw, like, creams and mints in it, like I remember, because that was cool, you know, and they'd be sloshed. And I was, like, this geeky kid, and they were like, this kid's so cool, and I was like, okay, so I'll be cool in high school, just 6 years away or whenever it was, like, I'll be cool then. And I'm, like, planning it in my head, like, the steps, like, I'll be cool in, like, ninth grade, so I just got, like, 4 grades to go. It can't be that bad. So then during the summers, I was hanging out with my dad, and I met this family, and they kind of took me under their wing, and this woman became like another mother to me, and her sons became like my brothers to me, and they would beat me up a lot. And, you know, they twist my arm and make me say uncle, and I hated it. And I hated everything going on in my life. I hated that my mom, I didn't know why my mom wasn't around. I don't know why my dad I can't live with my dad. I hate everything. I'm just really upset. And anytime someone touches me or hits me or if I fall, I just cry. And I was feeling completely powerlessness. I'm like 10 years old. I always say that because, like, I got sober when I was 17. But, you know, coming in, I had to find a way to relate. And I had the same emotions going on as everybody else I've heard in AA. But I had them much younger, and I don't know why. So I'm, like, feeling this powerlessness at 10 years old. And then I'm watching Lethal Weapon, and Mel Gibson said to Danny Glover, pain doesn't hurt unless you want it to. And I was like, okay, Mel. And I thought he was speaking to me, you know. I was like, okay, pain doesn't hurt unless you want it to. And I thought this was, like, my aha moment. Like, everything's going to be perfect now, you know. And so these boys would say, you know, something, and I was like, no. They're like, well, then they try to beat me up, and I'd be like, pain doesn't hurt unless you want it to. You know, completely cliche and corny. It was like, sounds like a movie. And, you know, and then they would keep beating me up, and I would just say, pain doesn't hurt unless you want it to. And eventually, the most amazing thing happened, like I thought. I went physically numb. You know, I eventually convinced myself, pain does not hurt at all. Like, they threw me off the porch, and I was like, ha-ha. You know, like, what are you going to do now? And I called them a lot of obscenities. You know, I found obscenities at this point, and I thought they were really funny. And I did that overuse of I don't care what you see teenagers did. I did that with a lot of curse words. And then they would threaten to beat me up, and I would run. And they eventually catch me, and I get beat up, and I always survive. And I just thought it was like this game, and I kind of liked it. And I started developing, like, what our book talks about, this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. You know, and in Queens, I was this Dr. Jekyll. I was this crazy person. I start fights. I was tough. You didn't mess with me. They really thought I was a crazy white girl. That's what they called me. Don't speak to her. She's crazy. You know, you just didn't know what I was going to do. Because I also wanted attention. So I would, like, dress up like a Christmas tree and say, I'm a Christmas tree. Make a wish like me. You know, make a wish on me. You don't do that in Queens when you're 11. You know, it's just a very strange sight. I'm with a lot of Hispanics. They're just like, what is she doing? I wish I had a picture. Thank God I don't. So, and then with my mom, I was a straight-A student. I took care of my brother. I did everything I was supposed to. I made breakfast. I made us lunch. I got us our dinner. We got A's on tests. I studied with my brother. I did everything I was supposed to do. And then whenever I was with my dad or my queens, I felt entitled to this other life that I was creating. And this was my release. And this is what made me get through my Monday through Friday because my life was so hard. And, you know, I didn't even start drinking yet, you know, but it was like kind of all coming to that point because I was just always seeking a release. Like, I just needed a break. I just needed that. And this numb thing was working for me for a while. And then one day in Queens. I don't remember my first drink because it just seemed to happen so naturally. Like, I had drinks with my family when I was like eight years old. My parents would have families. It's an Irish Catholic Italian household. Like, funerals are like the biggest party of the year. You know, on my dad's side, they have kegs, lots of kegs. It's very strange. And so I don't remember when I had my first drink. I know I had sips before then, but I remember I started drinking from my dad's liquor cabinet, and I take a couple shots of something, and I give it to the guys who are like my brothers, and they give a couple shots. I'm like, okay, now we got to fill it back up with water. And then, like, let's take a couple more shots, you know, and then, you know, eventually we got smart enough to be like, well, let's stop watering down this bottle, you know, let's just finish it, and then we'll fill it with something, like, you pee in it so it looks like it, you know what I mean? Like, because it was, I don't know what it was, maybe it was tequila, so urine looks kind of like that color, but whatever. And then I started going out making plans to get drunk when I was down in Queens, and I really enjoyed it. Like, I would say, I go to the corner store. I'm like, oh, my Aunt Miriam wants me to get her 240s, right? And I get OE, two bottles of OE, and I go to the Trussell's and I drink up there. And then I would walk around Queens drunk and, like, or ride a bike. I thought riding a bike drunk was very fun because I crashed into everything, and I thought it was hilarious. It wasn't even my bike. I borrowed it from a cop. I was like, that's, like, not a smart kid. You know, and that was, and then what would happen is Miriam or these brothers like Marshall David Jr., they would find me and they would be like, okay, Mom, she's drunk. And they just throw me up and hide me from my father. And, Miriam would slap me a little bit. You stupid girl. And she'd throw me in the shower. I'm like, I'm sorry. I'll never do it again. You know, and I do it again, always. You know, and sometimes I would drink with her sons and it just became like a normal ritual. Like, I just wasn't allowed to get drunk, you know. And I didn't understand that. And drinking for me wasn't like about taking a sip. It was like about chugging. Like, I had a 40. I'm going to finish it. I love chugging. I was all about chugging. You know, I found this great ability to like drop my throat. So I could really just, like, it was like a funnel going straight down. And I felt super tough. And I can take you. Now I have beer muscles. And I'm crazy. Yeah, and I start fights. And I thought it was great. And I never started fights with girls because I thought girls were pathetic. You know, I'm like, I'm too good to fight a girl. I need to fight guys. Get like the 6'1", biggest guy in the street, you know. And he's like, you can't take me. I'm like, no, but a bat can, and I'll get a bat. Like, and I had that crazy look. And you just felt like, she's going to get a bat. She's going to get something. And they're like, you're cool, you're cool. I'm like, yeah, I'm cool. Okay, yeah. And I'm like bouncing up and down all the time, and I'm talking like this. Like, yeah, what are we going to do? Like, that was me drunk. They're like, put her in the closet. Put her in the closet. You know, I'm like this hyper kid. I'm like 12 years old, 13, just bouncing off the walls. I had a lot of energy. And I still do. And so that's how my drinking started. And it just, and I loved it. And then once I was, you know, drinking and being numb, I felt, you know, like nothing could stop me. I felt like I was on fire. Like Bill talked, like I had arrived. Like, this is my solution to life. And I was so happy. And then all of a sudden, now I started stealing in Queens, and I started some bigger fights. Like, this wasn't like petty fights with friends I knew. I started a fight with some kids from Brooklyn, and because I almost got jumped, a kid got his head split open by a shovel. It was bad. You know, and I was like, and I knew that I was the cause of this, but I didn't know how to take it in at 12 years old either. And so now we're trying to hide, you know, now my friends are getting in trouble because of what I'm doing, because I was running my mouth. Like, I ran my mouth all the time. And then this kid stopped to, like, whack me. And I tell you, I got decked a couple times, you know, so I felt like I could always take it, like, and I could always survive it. Because our book talks about being delusional, because I thought there was a crazy person living inside of me. So if you hit me once, she'll come out, and then you better watch out. And I would talk about her, like, and it was very strange. Like, I was completely crazy. And I liked the idea of it. And one of the reasons why I liked the idea of it so much was because the crazier I was and the way I acted, it just kept everybody that far away from me or even further. Nobody wanted to get close to me. And that's how I wanted. I didn't want people to get close to me because you might leave me. I felt abandoned. I was scared. And I didn't know it was those feelings that I had inside of me. And I kind of felt like I'm surviving my life right now. I don't think I could survive somebody else leaving my life. And I don't want to experience it. So, like, I blocked everyone out from me. It's like I had Miriam, I had these boys, and my dad, and that's it, my brother. You know, that's it, I'm gold, and I'm sacrificing this girl, Maria. That's it. And I didn't want anybody else closer to me, because I couldn't take it. But then I started getting in trouble, and then my mom started to get sober, and that was kind of weird, and she made a decision to move to Jersey. And I kind of had this idea, like, I was like, Jersey? And I had this idea that when she got sober, that my life would go back to normal. Like, you know, I didn't know it was drinking, but she's like, okay, I'm going to be sober. I'm like, okay, so we're moving to Queens again, and you're getting back together with Dad. It's like, I didn't say this to her, but it's like in my head. Like, I had this expectation, and that's not what happened at all. She met a guy, Charlie, who's in their rooms, and he's like another father to me, and they decided to move to Vernon, New Jersey. Like, where is that? And I really, at that point, was so devastated. I couldn't even tell you, like, because I felt like I had my mom back, and everything was going to be the way it was supposed to, and then I felt like I mattered nothing, like, in an instant. Like, this just is not about me at all. You know, this is just about what my mom wants to do with her life. I'm just, like, the innocent bystander going along, you know, like, she's the conductor on the train, and it was a really crappy feeling. My parents then decided, we moved to Vernon. A year later, we moved to Stanhope. I'm still having this, you know, drinking on the weekends, getting in trouble, you know, straight-A student still. And then my parents decided that maybe Queens isn't the best place for Casey. She's getting in a lot of trouble. And my dad's a really passive person. And so pretty much you can, like, if I say, Dad, what do you want for dinner? He's like, what do you want for dinner? I'm like, Dad, what do you want for dinner? I did this once driving around a circle in New Jersey, you know, in the circles. I'm like, what do you want for dinner? You choose. He's like, no, you choose. I'm like, no, you choose. We're just I'm like, please make a decision. You know, he just won't make a decision. And I knew this about my dad from the beginning, so I know when he said, like, I don't want you coming to Queens, it was my mom. And I got so angry with her, like, this resentment filled in me. And I, like, went off on my mother, and I said some really horrible things to her. And I went off talking about, like, how she, you know, you're jealous because I consider Miriam my mother. She's more of a mother than you'll ever be. And I just hit all these weak spots. Like, I knew what all her weak spots were, and I just hit them. Like, operation, how's that feel? You want another one? You know? And, like, I'm numb. Like, I don't feel like it bothers me so much because I really do want my mom a part of my life. So I'm so emotional over it, but I'm trying to convince myself that I'm not. I'm trying to convince myself that I don't want this. And so they said I couldn't go to Queens. I wanted to kill myself, so I don't really remember exactly what it is. I think I took all the medication. I wrote a really crazy poem about the months of my life without you. And at the end, December, I said I'd kill myself because I can't live without you. They took it for real. You know, I was like, why would you do that, you know? Because they see me as insane. And I don't realize how people are seeing me like I'm not the same person anymore. And so I wind up in my first rehab. And I went to this rehab. And up to this point, like, I didn't feel like I qualified as an alcoholic or a drunk. Like, it just wasn't that much. Like, I didn't feel like I'm listening to these people's stories. And every single person there has done drugs. And I didn't do drugs. And I felt like such the outcast. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm such a loser. I gotta get out of here. I gotta do drugs. Not to talk about, but that's how I felt. Like, I'm just gonna do them. Because this is the worst feeling in the world, and I know I'm coming back to a place like this. I knew I was going back. You know, and so I was like, I'll just have to put that on my list of things to do. And, you know, I didn't really relate to any of these stories. I didn't have these problems. I wasn't feeling a compulsion to drink. Physically, I didn't have a mental obsession. And I didn't really know what else was going on. Like, I'm just upset. My mom sucks. I called her name's Cass. I changed it to the C-letter curse word that ends in T. That was, like, my favorite word for her. You know, and I called her that, Mama. And, or Mama Ass. No one of them. So, excuse my language. But it's, like, how I named my mom. It just came that. It just showed how, like, my upset with her. Like, she had her name, and then my resentment took over, and she lost her name. And that was just all my resentment and my anger. And after I got out of that rehab, I was there only 3 days, I really decided that what's the point? Like, no one's listening to me anyway. You know, everyone's listening to my mom. You know, no one cares what Casey wants. It's never been about what Casey wants, you know, or what Casey needs. So I'm just going to do what I want to do, you know? And that's what I did. And now I had no boundaries. You know, before that, I was a good student Monday through Friday. I had these kind of boundaries about what I had to do. So I was only getting in trouble on Saturdays, Sundays, if I was. And now it's like I'm just going to be this Dr. Jekyll all the time. I went into high school starting off like that. I got, within a week, I had detention till the end of the school year. Like, with the principal. I don't even know what I did. You know, but it was like this. And then a teacher made fun of me, so I threw a gas at her. Like, I was like, I'll show you. Like, you're playing checkers. I'm playing chess. This is me, baby. She's like, leave my classroom. You know? Like, this is how I was acting in college, in high school. And then I just started drinking, and I did anything I could. I just always had lines to escape for myself. I do have drugs in my story, but I really know that I'm an alcoholic. Like, I suffer from the ism. You know? And as a kid, it just, you know, glue was a lot more accessible sometimes than alcohol. So, you know, huff and glue is what it was sometimes. But I killed a lot of brain cells. And so I started going off without any limits, just drinking and doing whatever I want whenever I could. And my mom was going off, putting me in every institution New Jersey had to offer for rehab. I went to St. Clair's twice. I went to Carrier. I had the youth advocate program, like the big sister. Like, I was a handful for her. You know, and I still remember she was like a virgin. And I was like, oh my God, that's like unheard of. She was like 22, this pure soul. I'm like, oh, I'm going to corrupt you. That's my goal. You know, like, I need to corrupt her. You know, and it was just an interesting time for me. Like, it just all seemed like a joke because in my head, I made a decision. Like, I made this decision to be crazy. I can stop whenever I want. I chose to party. I'm choosing to do all this because I said, I'm just going to do what I want to do. You know, I never felt that alcohol was making these decisions in my life. Or not alcohol, I'm just sort of say, but my disease was making them. You know, like, I thought these were my decisions. So when I went to rehab, and they're telling me you have a problem, and you were doing all this therapy. I mean, I definitely had issues. Like, I do have issues, you know. But, you know, like, I just didn't see it all. Because, like, for me, like, this is how it was. And Carrier, it was, like, my third rehab. I really wanted to get high or get drunk or get something. It's not going to happen unless you assault the staff. If you assault the staff, they shoot you up with Thorazine. So I started assaulting the staff. You know, logical conclusion. That got me sent to the crazy ward. You know, and that was really scary. I got actually sent to Edwards Hall. It was a legitimate psych ward. And I'd never been around real crazy people. And no one would talk to me. And I remember... They put you on meds. You don't have a choice in places like this. When you go to there, you don't have a choice in what prescriptions they're going to put you on. So now they're deciding to put me on all these prescription drugs. And I'm like, I don't want to take them. Can I speak to my doctor? They just ignore you. You're like this, you're like white noise in this room, you know? And I was like, this was a bad, bad idea. Like, how do you get out of the crazy world? You just can't say, I'm not crazy. It was an act. It was an act. Like, no one's going to believe me. I did it as a joke. It's a really bad joke. It's like the joke's on me. And I'm like, this was a really bad idea. Really bad idea. And, you know, eventually, like a week later, I got sent back to my adolescent unit. And I was like, oh, I love you guys. I'll never do it again. And they decided that something more was needed for me, and I went to a residential home. And I went to a residential home in Orfield, Pennsylvania. And that was, like, worse than Whitehall, where the castle was. And I was there for 6 months, you know. And I can tell you that I just tried to walk the walk and talk the talk. You know, like, I didn't believe any of these things applied to me. Like, I saw some of the things going on, but like I said, I made these decisions, so I just wanted to do it. And I really blamed my mother for everything that went wrong in my life. It really was her fault. If she didn't do this, if she was this way, then everything would be okay. And I always believed that in my heart of hearts. I didn't know that that was my, that, I didn't know that though until I got sober. You know, like I always was focusing on her. I didn't realize that like, you know, it had to do with me and my feelings because I never wanted to talk about my feelings. I just wanted to talk about what she did wrong and she's such this and she's just controlling and she doesn't know anything. And, you know, so it's interesting when they asked me to speak on powerlessness because I was powerless, you know, throughout my whole drugging, you know, my drinking and drugging. you know, I never got to make a decision in these places. Like, you have to earn levels. You have to be good, and you get more levels, and you get more freedom. I just can never get to the orange level. Like, no matter what, I was always on the gray level, which you can't talk to people, which for me was, like, hell. Like, I can't talk. You know, they, like, make you face a corner. I'm like, this is hell. Please get me out of here. Now I'm, like, begging. I, like, want to be nice to my mom to get out of here. You know, eventually, though, insurance money eventually always does run out. And I left. And my school decided that, you know, maybe Casey doesn't need to finish out the school year. It's April. Because I've been in and out of institutions since, like, November. You know? So they were like, you could just keep her out. And at this point, now I'm just hanging out with, you know, other kids who are like, the same person like me, and my drinking just escalated. You know, I met other guys and girls, and my drinking just consumed a larger amount of proportions. You know, I was drinking like anytime I could, all the time. I didn't want to pay for anything, so I was always drinking with guys, and I was always willing to pay that price for drinking with guys. You know, I used to drink at my friend Pete's house, and interesting thing, you know, Pete was a great guy. Whenever he got drunk, crazy things would happen. He was always like locking me in a bedroom or locking me in a bathroom. And I kind of thought, that's okay. Like, I'll just deal with it. Like, and I always got out. You know, one day he locked me in a bedroom and his like friend was in there and I threw myself through the window. And he, like, I dusted myself off and I'm like, where's my shot? You know, like, that's all I want. And I'm like, I'm okay with this. Like, nothing ever happened. Like, this is just what it costs to drink for free. And I was okay with that. And then, you know, it would always get escalated. Like, one time I was in the bathroom, and I really couldn't get out. And I was banging on the door, begging my friend Joya to open. I'm like, Joya, I'm screaming, because it's, like, really tiny, this bathroom. It's, like, the size of this, where I'm standing. And he has to, like, push up against the wall, and he's, like, big and fat. And, excuse my description. But, like, so I'm smothered. I'm like, ugh. And I'm like, I know I can't get out of this. And I'm an egomaniac. So I'm like, I actually know I can't get out of this. So I'm like trying, and I'm screaming for joy to like open the door, and she just never comes. And eventually I get out, and I just remember being like, I think I kissed him or something, and I was just like, ugh, you know, like so frustrated and so pissed off. I'm like, I got to come up with a better way, you know, and eventually I got out, and it was like, all right, well, it wasn't that bad. You know what I mean? Like, I'll just drink some more. Like, that just always was my solution. And then I ate Doritos, and then I puked. I'm like, don't do that again. You know, or just puke all the time. You know, eat Doritos and drink, so you puke, no one will want to ever kiss you. You know, it's like, these are like the thoughts that I would have. And I didn't care about it because it just allowed me the luxury of drinking. I went back to high school in Lenape Valley, which Lenape Valley was a really interesting school my sophomore year. And I assaulted the vice principal. That didn't go over too well at all. And he, at that point, has had it with me. He's like, I just want her out. I'm done. I want her out. And I'm like, fine. And my mom's like, you need to pay for education. You know, you can't just kick my daughter out. You have to at least provide her with some sort of education. She's all like coming in there. You know, you have to pay for a private school for her. And today she got them to pay for a private school for me. And I went to an emotionally disturbed school. And I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. You know, because for me, I was like, I'm emotionally disturbed. Yeah. You know, it's like a Girl Scout badge. I'm like, yeah, I got this badge. You know, and I was like so proud of it. It was like a very, but it was my poor mother. Like, I cannot imagine. I'm like, I'm 5'7", brown hair, brown eyes, and I'm emotionally disturbed. You know, like that's how I would describe myself. You know, what are your hobbies? Being emotionally disturbed, so like hurting people, you know, stealing. Like, it was funny to me. It was so funny. And I can tell you, though, that I love this school. I actually did. It was Windsor. It's in Morristown. And it saved my life. But I went to the school, and they make it really easy for you. The bus comes to your house because they know you're not walking. It starts like 9 to 2 because they know anything more than that is way too stressful for emotionally disturbed kids. You know, you get smoke breaks like 3 times a day. You get to go out for lunch. You don't get homework because they know you don't do it. Like, this is like my type of school. Like, they know you're not going to do it. So they don't bother. So it's really like you got 4 hours of school, you know, outside the gym where it's like this quality time, and that's when they're going to pump you full of all this knowledge just to hopefully get you a job. And but it was the first time in my life that, like, I was surrounded by kids who were just like me. you know? And it was like the nicest feeling in the world. It's like being in AA when you finally find your answer. And you know you're just sitting in a room where everyone just, you know, just knows what you're going through. It's like, that's what I felt like. I felt like every guy and every girl in the school just knew what I was going through. And I just fit in. You know, it was like no cool language. It didn't matter what I looked like. And it was such a nice feeling. And everybody in the school is an alcoholic or a drug addict. It was like an instant network of partying. Like I'm with Gina Monday, I'm with Beth on Tuesday, I'm with Jay and Mike on Wednesday. And it was just, you know, for me at like 16, I'm like, this was awesome. You know, I felt like this was like the top of my life. And now I'm like, I made all these friends in the city, and I'm partying and getting into clubs. And like, this is my life, and this is like what I was born to do, and I'm doing like all this cool weaving. I'm like, I'm so hip. Like, yeah, I feel these trails. Whoa. You're still here, but you left the room. Like, I spoke like that. People are like, you know, it's so sad. You know, and I think this is like so great, and everything just kind of started to go along pretty smoothly. And then like anything, it just escalated, and I kind of like, I crossed that line where everything stopped being a choice and it started being a necessity. And I was kind of like, I didn't know that though. Like all of a sudden my life changed and I didn't know it was because of my drinking. Like I didn't know, like now I have to do it. It was no longer a choice. Now I'm waking up in a motel room and I'm naked and there's urine all over the the floor. And they told me it was me, but I have no idea how that happened. I'm like, really? They're like, yeah, you pissed next to the toilet. You didn't decide to piss in it. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, yeah, we thought so too. And I'm like, okay. Like, I have no idea of any of this. Like, tons of stories are coming that I don't know. I'm really not okay with it. You know, I never had relationships because I had one guy go psycho on me. So talking about the, like, delusional, and, you know, they talk about in their book, the insane idea always won out. So, you know, I love that line because it's so true for me. So I had this one bad relationship with this guy who, like, got possessive and, like, stalked me. So I was like, I'm never going to sleep with my boyfriend again. I'm only going to sleep with strangers. That's, like, a successful life. I don't have any more problems. You know, I'll have emotional connections with friends, but I'll sleep with strangers. It's like the best of both worlds. You wind up feeling like a whore, you know, like at one point, I just feel like this whore because I'm like packing out my clothes everywhere and just walking home. I'm like, okay, but I'm okay with this. This is your choice. Yep, I'm good, and I'm the cool chick. I left. You know, I'm so cool. He's going to be stalking me down, you know, like, and I would like convince myself like this was, because that was the best idea, because I wanted some companionship, but you know, like I just didn't want to deal with the psycho thing. And I remember telling this to my high school counselor. And she just looked at me. And then she was like, well, why don't you just not have sex? I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, have you had it? It's like, great. You know, and it's so not at 16. You're like, you just don't even know. It's like, you're awkward still. You know? And so she was like, okay, well then, maybe pick one or pick three and you rotate them. I'm like, that's a good idea. Three, I'll rotate them. That way my numbers don't get higher. I'm not feeling that bad about myself. I'll talk to them about it. It'll be like a business deal. She's like, that's not what I meant. That's all I heard. So this is how I'm living. You know, I'm like, I have random guys that I sleep with. I treat myself like crap. I really, you know, I do allow anyone to kind of just disrespect me. I have no self-worth. And I'm drinking all the time, and I'm doing whatever I can actually all the time just to get out of my skin, you know? And this is not how my life, I want my life to go, but it's just the way it's going right now. I actually got kicked out of this emotionally disturbed school after assaulting the principal there, you know? He actually allowed me to stay, but then I fumed out. Like, I had too many absences because I just couldn't get up at 8 o'clock in the morning. Like, that became too hard. You know, it became too hard to roll out of bed to go onto the bus because that's what I used to do. Or my bus driver always knew I would be there at 8 o'clock. And so wherever I was partying, I would like run home sometimes a mile. I'd run home, like, let me just get a new pair of panties. Like, I had no filter. Like, that's how I was. He's like, TMI. You know, it's like the bus driver. He doesn't want to know anything like this for you. And I would go in and then change and come back and then I'd sleep. And that was the only time I would sleep, the 20-minute ride to school. And I just couldn't do it anymore. But I did love the school. And it did save my life up to the point that I got kicked out. Because, well, up to that point, what happened is I used to have really good friends who actually did care about me. you know. And then my drinking just kind of pushed all those good friends away, and I kind of got all these like people like me, you know, and I was a scumbag. You know, I didn't really care about you. Like, I could only care about you if I knew where I was drinking first that night, or I already was very drunk, or I already had what I needed. You know, then I could help you, and then I could care about you or whatever you needed. But until that happened, you were not a priority. And so I had all these like fair weather friends, as our book talks about, and things would get really hairy at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I remember this one night where my friends wanted to rob a bank. And I was like, that's a bad idea, you know? So I was like, okay, that sounds cool. And I like always felt committed to my word. So I'm like, well, I said I would do it, so now I have to do it. I really don't want to rob a bank because that's just stupid. No one ever gets away with it. It's like, why are they that dumb? But I couldn't tell them no, you know? And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I don't want to do this. But somehow along the path of being me, I got court ordered to go to school. Like all the things you're supposed to do normally, like go to bed, go to school, like at 16, became court ordered for me to do. Like I was court ordered to go to bed by 1 a.m. If not, I could be sent to juvenile detention. Like that's retarded, but it happened. I still had the paperwork from it. Like you're court ordered to go to school or the cops get called. Like you're court ordered to wear clothes. It was like ridiculous. Some of it. Like you're court ordered to eat 3 meals with your mom. It was, you know, you have to stop calling your mom's name. It came all court ordered. I don't know how my mom got that done, but she did. And so she probably didn't, but it worked out in her favor. So what happened is, and all my friends kind of knew that I always had to be home in time for school because the cops would always then come looking. And I lived in Stanhope. It's a really small town, and the cops just know where to find me. So I was like, oh my God, I have to go to school, so I can't rob the bank. And I would run out the door. Gotta go to school. And that became my out, like, every time, though. Because I could never say no. Because I really wanted you to like me, and I wanted to fit in, and I just wanted to be cool. And I just didn't know, I didn't have any respect for myself, so I could never say no. Like, being able to say no and set boundaries, which I'm able to do in my life today, comes from, like, loving who I am, and I didn't. So I couldn't do those things back then. So once I got kicked out of school, it's kind of like I fell apart. You know, my mom said, okay, you have no more rules. You could do whatever you want. And she did that in hopes that I would hit bottom. And I did. But she, let me tell you, I can't imagine that feeling because she had went to me sharing about it. Like, I hope she's not going to die. You know, because I had no limit. And anybody who knew me knew that. And my mom would always drop me off in AA meetings. I was in AA meetings all the time, especially up in NetCon, Stanhope, Bud Lake area. They all kind of knew me. Everyone stayed away from me because I was like fuming with anger. Because they would say, my name's Casey, and they would call me Cassie. My best one mother. You know? And they're like, I'm sorry. And so now I have no limits. And I, you know, with my mom, like I can just do whatever I want. And I hit rock bottom really quick. It was in August of 96 is when the light bulb went on, so to speak. I was in Washington Heights, so you guys figure out why. And the guy I was dating, I decided to date this guy. And he sold me for crack. And I had a really rude awakening. And I was in this apartment building, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I was in the bathroom, actually. And they had, like, a drug deal going down. Or not a drug deal, I'm sorry, a gun deal going down in the other room. And a guy blocking the door. And it was kind of like the first time I knew, like, I'm not getting out of this situation. And I'm in trouble. And I was like, I'm not going out there. I'm like, you better say something. I'm not doing it. And I'm like, muster up the cards. I'm like, okay, it's 3 stories high. I'm going to jump out the window. And I finally get the courage, like, the lip of the shade. And it's like a brick wall. Sucks. And I don't know what this guy said, but he comes back in and he says, you know, we can go. I'm like, what do you mean we can go? He's like, we can go. You know, and I have no idea what happened, but I walked out of that, you know, that apartment without having to do anything. And that was I patted myself on the back though. I'm like, good job, Casey, you got yourself out of another one. You know? And I would continuously go back to that apartment after that incident. And I started to realize I had a problem. A couple of days later, the cops found me. My mom reported me as a runaway. And I assaulted 3 officers, and I sent 2 of them to the hospital. And I was losing my mind. I was on a kind of like a binge going on like 3 days, 7 days, 3 to 7 days. I don't even know. I wasn't sleeping. I was just drinking around the clock and other substances, and I like lost it. They arrested me. I got put in a jail cell. I was wearing size like 40 jeans with a belt because like if I don't know, I thought it was cool. So when they took my belt away, like my pants just fell to the ground. You know, and they're like, pick them up. I'm like, they're not gonna ever fit. You know, like really, they're like 40. Because like I used to buy these big jeans because then I would put 40s in them and seal them in Quick Check and then loosen the belt, you know, and then tuck the pants into it so that way if they ever fell, I walk out like. So, but and so I was like, whatever. So I go into this jail cell, and I'm sweating, I'm panting, and I just want something so bad, and I'm shaking so bad. And it was the first time I started to see the effects of alcohol and my decisions had on my life. And I knew at that moment I was an alcoholic. And because for me, my definition of alcoholic is someone who's physically dependent upon drugs or alcohol. And at that point in my life, I was physically dependent, and I was living on the streets, you know? And that's what I thought an alcoholic was. At that point, I surrendered, and I told my mom for the first time, like, I want to get help. Like, I'm not trying to get out of these charges. I just want to get help. And she said, okay. And then she had some people there with NAA. The cops came in, they asked me everything that was going on, and it was the first time I was, like, cooperative. I told them everything that's been going on, who I've been with, everything I can remember. And then they decided to let me go. My mother was yelling at them. I found out 10 years into sobriety, I find out, because we never talked about that day, right? But she's like, you can't let her go. She needs to hit bottom. Everybody keeps taking away her consequences. And the cops are like, ma'am, you don't want your daughter with 3 counts of assault on officers going in, you know, thinking you just don't want her to have this. She's like, yes, I do. I have a much nicer God than my mother's, you know? So my mom asked me with this other guy, they're like, if we take you home, you won't jump out of a car, right? You're not going to jump. I'm like, why would I jump out of a moving car? That's, like, crazy. And the reason why they asked me this, because the cops found me in a hotel before I got to this jail cell, and I was in a second-floor hotel, and I jumped out of the window. You know, so that's why they're asking me this. And so I have a thing about jumping out windows. And so I said, no, I'm not going to jump out of a car. That's crazy. You know, like, not like if it's moving, you know. And I told my mom, and my mom just went off that night. You know, I went home. She started looking for rehab. And I didn't want to go to rehab anymore. You know, I had alcohol in my system, and I didn't have a choice anymore. You know, like, I had to go get drunk. I had to have something. You know, like, I was no longer drinking out of a want anymore. Or by choice, I was drinking out of necessity, you know, and I had to drink, you know, and I went off to the races, and I continued to drink until August 17, 1996. My mom found me for a rehab, and at the time, my mom said, found a rehab for me, and the only thing I believed, I had two moral beliefs, and that was, you know, I would babysit the kids occasionally. I don't know why they would let me with them, but I am pretty good with kids. And it's like, whatever your mother says goes, and that you have to have a high school diploma, or else you're never going to go anywhere in life. It's the only two things I believe. I would steal from you. I really thought that was okay. I would beat you up. I thought pretty much everything else was okay in life. But those two things, I felt like you had to have a high school diploma, and whatever your mother says goes. And God is so good, because those are the only two things I needed to get sober, as crazy as I was. I'm sure you guys get I was a lot out of my mind. Because when the way they got me into rehab was that's the only way you could get back to high school is you would go to rehab. Go to rehab then, you know. But I wanted it to be different because I did surrender and I knew I needed to, you know. And I knew I was powerless now. Like I knew that I knew I could not do this on my own, you know. And right before I went to rehab, I found this woman. I asked her to be my sponsor. And she's kind of been 12-stepping me for the whole summer months, like June and July. And so she talked my language, like the language that we know in AA, and I was willing to do the things that she was talking about, you know, and outlining in this program. And so I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, of course. And then I decided I wanted a different experience. And, you know, I found like, since I knew I was powerless now, I knew that, like, I just couldn't, you know, she told me just not to drink. Like, try not to drink or do anything before rehab. And I was like, okay. You know, like, I'm seeking her for direction. Because I know now I don't know what I'm supposed to do. You know, up to this point, I thought I knew everything I had to do to have a successful life. And now I know that I don't. I don't have the information. I don't know what it is. So I'm listening to this woman. So on August 17th, I decided not to drink or drug. And I stayed sober 3 days before I went into rehab on my own. And because I just wanted a different experience. You know, I went into rehab. They didn't search me well enough. I still had drugs on me. I didn't even know it. And I actually turned them in. You know, I was like, here you go. I had an emotional breakdown and I cried for 3 days straight. And it was the first time I cried since I couldn't even tell you when I remember, maybe since I was 12. Like, I kind of gave up on the idea. And it wasn't like crying, like kind of cute or anything. Like, oh, she's crying. It was like, like hyped for 3 days. Like, I was so was not like cute or anything, you know, because you still want to be that at 17, like cute in rehab, like because there might be that guy there who has just as many issues as you have, and you're like, that's your true love, you know? No, you know? So, and it was the first time, and I had asked a really great counselor because I was like, you know, I just feel like such a whore, and they're like, you are a whore. Okay, you know, and but I was really blessed because I got people in my life, and I know it sounds really harsh, but they knew that if I didn't get this, I was going to die, and I really believe that. You know, that's why for me at 17, I got sober. Like, I can be 31 today and know that I still need to be in this room. Like, I'm clear. I fit the black parts of that book. I never have a doubt. You know, like I had a really rough today. I still struggle with powerlessness and unmanageability in my life. I overcommit myself all the time. You know, and I think I control the world around me. I think I control like 15 kids who are 8. It's like such a joke. I'm like, how do I bribe you just to listen to me today? You know, but so I was in this rehab and they actually told me everything. You know, they told me the truth. You know, you're going to die. You just got to do this thing. And the only time I stopped crying was on when my counselor had me read page 449 to the end, which is acceptance is the answer, I think it's now, or the key in the fourth edition. It's another page in the fourth edition, but in the third edition. And all it did was give me a little bit of hope, you know, and that's what I needed. And then on the fifth day, I got the call from my mother, who was making all the decisions in my life. By the way, you're not coming home. You're going to live with your sponsor. Okay, and in 6 months' time, you've been through the steps, and then you can come home and live with me. I'm like, oh, I have a time limit? You know, like, who gets a time limit? You know, I'm like, I don't want to live with my sponsor. I want to live with you. She's like, no. I was like so upset with her. And I was upset because I knew this woman, Roseanne, was going to kick my butt. And I knew I wasn't going to get away with anything, and I wasn't going to be able to manipulate her, you know? And so I move in with my sponsor after rehab, Root Awakening. She has like 2 kids. And I started to babysit them a little bit with her and help her during the summer months. And that's how we got to know each other. And she actually gave me a room and started me with the big book and going through from the preface. You know, she told me the biggest thing that she told me that helped me was my first step. She said, your head's a broken computer and gives you all the wrong direction. You know, so, you know, basically, you're just not going to make any decisions. I was like, okay. You know, like, I was okay with that. Because in my head, I was like, great, because if anybody doesn't like what I'm doing, I'm going to blame it on you. It's like, it's Roseanne. That's what she told me to do. I'm in the clear. You know, but it made, you know, but it was really clear. And I learned that from the doctor being in Bill's story. Like, I just didn't know how to, like, my head tells me to drink. My head tells me if you hurt my feelings, I can bash your face in. That's the same idea to me. What's wrong with that? You know, it's like, that's how I think. And that basically I have to go through the steps. And if I go through the steps, I get my thinking back, you know, later. And we started going through the steps. And it was, I said that like 4 times. And then I started to see how, with her, that she started telling me that, you know, that for me, you know, like I surrendered at this point and I was no longer fighting. You know, I wasn't trying to, like, get over anybody. I wasn't trying to figure it out. You know, I really surrendered to her. And that's what made just getting to this program easier for me and helping me with the first step. Because really the first step for me was listening to my sponsor. You know, she secured my trust by telling me about herself, that I knew what she was talking about. I knew she was a real alcoholic. I knew she wasn't a moderate or a hard drinker. You know, she was a real alcoholic. And she worked these steps, and this is what saved her life. you know, and that I'm going to have to trust her, and she's going to kind of guide me and show me how to live, you know. And she would remind me all the time, I know you, you know, because I would be freaking out because I was like, my mom told me I have to finish a step in 6 months. She's like, just be where your feet are today. You know, and she brought me, like, you just have to be where your feet are today. You know what I mean? We'll worry about that when that time comes, you know. And it was so hard because I hated my mom. Feeling, you know, so powerless. She's still making so many decisions in my life, and I want a voice. I want people to hear me, you know. Like, and you know, what I learned was that, like, I can't act like a lunatic. You know, I have to act like a responsible person, like an earthling. I didn't know what that was, and my sponsor showed me how to do that. And by doing that, it showed me how to live in a proper way where people would hear me. That when I would speak, people would listen. If I didn't drop the C word, the F bomb, the MF bomb, you know, like every other word. And if I would speak from my heart, and if I was willing to kind of sometimes let the walls down a little bit and speak the truth. Mom, I'm really scared. I just don't want to do this. I'm scared you might drink on me again. And let her know those things. And it's by doing that stuff and really talking from my heart and not talking out of fear and out of all my care to Jesus is how I talked before. You know, and I started with the first step. It always starts with the first step because it's like my sponsor earned my trust and she started to convince me, you know, and then it tells us on 19 and 20, like, you have to think of other people. She's like, you have to think of your mother. I'm like, I hate her. You know, she's like, you have to think about her. You know, see what you can contribute. See what you can bring, you know. And what started happening is by starting to bring to each situation, like being a good person, like cleaning up after the meeting, helping it get set up, first starting being like responsible in AA, I started to feel really good about who I was. And I started to think I could really do this, you know. I built a life in AA, and my life has now flourished outside of AA, you know. I still remember, up until I was like 10 years sober, people used to be like saying to me, I would love to party with you. I'm like, you know, just by hanging out with me because of my energy level. Nobody says that to me anymore. You know, like, I can deck myself in a different way at an energy level, and I know that I'm a good model of AA regardless. You know, someone, you know, to find out I was AA, they would see I'm a good person. You know, I learned so much from the first step, especially how delusional I am. You know, I can convince myself into anything. At 4 years sober, my mom told me, not my mom, my sponsor told me, you have to be nice to your mom. You know, because I really struggled with this resentment. And I'm not going to go into that because that's other steps. You know, so the best idea I had was I'll help my mom. I'm living with my mom now. I went back home at 2 years sober. It's like maybe 3 or 4 years sober. My mom, my sponsor's like, you have to be nicer. You have to just really, like, be like a good daughter. Because you really want her in your life. Because if you didn't, it really wouldn't bother you how she was. I was like, okay. So she said to me, be nice. And I was like, okay. So in my head, I was like, I'll help. My mom's taking Ginkgo Biloba to help her memory. So I was like, I'll help her think she's losing her mind. Right? I'll move everything in the house. And I won't tell her. And then I'll be really nice to her. And that way I'm being kind and loving. I really thought I was being kind and loving by helping her lose her mind. And I thought it was, and we had the best year that year. Everything was so great. I'm like, I love you, Mom, as I'm moving her ashtrays. He's like, you know what I mean? I'm hiding things on her. You know, like if she was smoking, using the left, this round ashtray, I put it to a square one. Like, I was crazy. You know, but I was like much nicer to her. I started to see better qualities about her that I'd never seen before. And the point is that like, in my head, when I live in fear and when I'm not willing to kind of like let God completely in and I still hold on to some of my defects of character, the delusional idea will always be with me. Like, I just suffer from it, you know? And it doesn't matter how much time I have, you know? Because I've been in relationships, you know, and I could see that he was not my ideal. And I could see that he was hurting me and disrespecting me. But I believed that I wanted someone not to give up on me if I was a bad person. And I wanted someone to love me regardless if I screwed up. So I stayed with someone knowing they were hurting me because my beliefs, right here, on my fear-based beliefs, you know, thinking that I'm not good enough, kept me in something. I didn't drink, you know what I mean? It was a really hard time in my life. You know, but it's like that point where I just couldn't differentiate the true from the false. And I couldn't express to somebody these were my beliefs that were tying me to this relationship. I had to walk through it. And in my first step, I learned how to walk through life on life's terms. Not on Casey's terms, because it's never going to be good enough. It never will be good enough, you know? But I learned to walk through life as it is, and if I invite God and keep my sponsor, you know, in my life and holding me accountable and telling her all those thoughts in my head, telling her I feel like crap. I think Casey's a piece of crap today. I think I'm dumb. I think I'm not smart enough. Because to me, those are the thoughts at 13 years that kind of disconnect me from God. Those are the thoughts even at 5, 10 years that drift me further away from God, the sunlight of spirit, and closer to a drink. They eventually will lead me back to a drink. I believe that. My negative thinking. I have to balance it with positive polarity. And the way I do that is by giving. You know, I learned to give by coming to AA. And by coming to AA, then my sponsor helped me learn how to give in my life, like how to show up for the people I love. You know, and that, you know, I have ability to make boundaries today. And in my relationship with my mom, I'm not powerless anymore. You know, I'm powerless over her. She made some really crazy decisions. She moved to New Hampshire. I think that's a crazy decision, you know. But it's like what I can do then is I can't focus on what she's doing. What I have to focus on, what can I do then? You know, and make it really clear. This is what I can do then. You know, like I want my mom more a part of my life. Well, then I have to make myself more available to her. You know, it's like today I wanted to like study the big book, read like all the beginning chapters, throw out all these cool lines and sound really witty and completely, you know, because I was a little intimidated. It's been a while since I spoke at Bernardsville. I'm like, oh, like this is where my mom got sober. I want to impress. And, you know, God is really good to me, not because and I wanted to run because I'm competing. I'm training for a competition, so I also had to run and do all this stuff. But I didn't sleep enough last night, so it's raining, pouring rain. And then my nephew winds up in the hospital today, and he's okay. And I can tell you that at first, though, I'm like, you know, God damn it, it's raining. I need to run. You know, I'm like all upset. Like, I have plans today, you know. Like, I need to do these things. And then, like, nothing went how I wanted to today at all. And I was just like, you know, I have to just, like, okay, I have to throw my hands up, hit my knees and surrender. Okay, God, obviously what I wanted is not of any concern to you. What would you like me to do? I'm now willing. I'm so willing. You know, and I'm like, and that's it. And then you know what happens? My day turns around. I feel really good about the decisions I made. I showed up for my nephew. I showed up for my family, you know. And you know what? I'm probably getting sick because I ran like tons of 15 snotty kids today who all are sick. So I'm probably not meant to run. And I can be okay with that. But what helps me to do that is to see how, like, my thoughts and what I want to do can make my life so unmanageable. I just put unreasonable demands on myself all the time. You know, and so I have to kind of, you know, work the other steps about stopping and looking to see what's going on. You know, like, is these decisions I'm making my life unmanageable? I have to look at the decisions I'm making. Are they making my boyfriend's life unmanageable? And who's not in the program? Like, I need to be considerate of those around me. And the steps teach me how to consider those inside and outside of the room to see what I'm doing. You know, like, am I showing up 100% today? You know, the first step talks about being 100%. So am I taking care of myself 100% today to be there 100% for the kids I tease, to be for the women I sponsor, you know, and all the, you know, my family? Or am I half measuring it? You know, like, what am I doing? You know, are my priorities God, AA, and then Casey's, you know, Casey's responsibilities, which is being a student, go, you know, my student teaching job. What I want to do is at the bottom. But if I do everything that's on top, I'll get to have, you know, everything come true for me. And my wildest dreams have come true in AA, I can tell you. That by just, like, surrendering and trusting a sponsor who became my guide to developing a relationship with God, you know, because I didn't have it in the beginning, so she was it. She was my channel till I got through the steps. Now I have a direct line with God. But that's why it's really important to have a sponsor who works the steps, is outlined in the big book, because they're the ones who are going to kind of guide you through the black parts to build that channel to a higher power. So I'm going to stop there. It's 9:05. I know you have some, like, to leave 10 minutes open for questions or comments. I'd like to thank you so much for having me, and thank you. Thank you.